Speaker
James.
Oh, I'm James. First, I want to thank John V. for asking me to share tonight. He asked me about 6 weeks ago, and he didn't tell me where it was, or what it was. And he's not here tonight, which I find it's kind of like the chef leaving just before dinner's served. You know, so if you when you see him next, tell him, God, John, guy didn't speak a word of English. What's wrong? happy birthday. Hello, Michael. Happy birthday to everyone who took a birthday cake. Something I love about as I was sitting there, I was like, yeah, something I love about Al-Anon is I can slip and fall on my face, and it still counts. You know, it's like falling. For years I've been saying falling on my face is still forward motion, and it really is. You know, I come from the idea that I'm supposed to know something before I do it. You know, and welcome to the newcomers. I also got to tell this. I have a friend here, Tony. I've never been to this meeting. And I've heard it's the world's greatest men's stag, right? All right. I mean, that's just the exposure of it. And so I'm feeling like Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes, walking up here, you know. And then I start seeing all these people, and I'm like, and then I remember that there's a lot of people in here that I've known for a long time and love dearly. Men, I will say that in public. And I have respect for, you know, and there's people here that when they share, I wish I shared like them. You know, that's how I have gleaned recovery, is listening through your shares. Because, you know, if I'm a guy, all right, there's this thing called alexithymia. I think that's the word. Is that you can't the inability to express feelings. And as a guy, is like I don't always have words for what's happening right now. So often I'll hear someone share and go, "Oh yeah, yeah, that's how I felt." So back to growing up and feeling like I should know things I'll tell you, one of the gifts of the program is a friend of mine brought her motorcycle over to my house, and she's, "Could you tighten these bolts down?" All right, I have motorcycles. I have limited mechanical experience, and I have this torque wrench. And I get on there, and it goes, snap! And I'm like, oh no. And I find out my torque wrench is broken. So I have to take the engine apart to get these bolts out. Now, normally I'm like, oh my God, well, I'm like all fretting and sweating and all that. And I kid you not, I was like, oh my God, there's an instruction manual for this. You know, it's like, I didn't use instruction manuals. I didn't go solicit wiser men before program. You know, I would do it in the dark, you know, dark of home, but, you know, I signed up for this dance class about 15 years ago, and I was just like, man, I was so sweating it out because I didn't know how to dance. Think about it for a sec, all right? I'm serious. So, I didn't know why I was here. Didn't know why I was why I would. I didn't know why I qualified for Al-Anon. I didn't live with any practicing alcoholics. I wasn't married to one. I wasn't dating one. My parents are not drinkers. When they drink, it works. You know, my dad would be, I would consider my qualifier, because I was told if someone's drinking or sobriety bothers me, I'm in the right place. And his sobriety bothered me. But I knew it was when he would have a glass of wine at dinner, I would feel the relief of like, oh, you know, he'd have one or two glasses of wine and we'd be good. You know, that would just chill him out. So it took me a couple of years. If you don't really know why you're here, please be patient. So my grandfather on my father's side and grandmother were off the boat from Poland, from Chicago. They were raised in Chicago. He was a body and fender man and a drunk, and one of his clients was Al Capone. So car would come by, all torn up in the middle of the night. They'd go pounding on his door. He was usually drunk, and they'd say, you need to fix this. And he'd fix it, he'd paint it, reupholster it, have it out on the street by the middle of the day, the next day, as an alibi. My grandmother, she had a candy shop, but at the back door, moonshiners would arrive from southern Illinois with moonshine, with jugs and jugs of moonshine. She'd take it upstairs, they'd clean out the bathtub, and then they would start browning sugar on the stove to pour in the moonshine. They would pour all the moonshine in the bathtub, and then they would start coloring the moonshine. So if you're selling rum, you sweetened it a lot. If you're selling scotch, you left it real tart. Gin, you just left it the way it is. And my dad would be there. He had an oar, and he would stir it. That's what he did. So then they would bottle it, and the Chicago cops would come to the front door and pick it up and take it to the speakeasies. So in my family is, there's no right or wrong. It's like, it's what you can get away with. You cheat on your taxes, if you can get away with it, So my grandparents, they were guilty of pretty much every crime but murder in the house. Molestation, beating each other up. My dad and on my mother's side, her father was a lifetime postal worker, but they were off the boat from Austria. Now, if you've done any research about Austria, there's a lot of research about child rearing in Austria and Germany and that part of Europe leading up to the First and Second World War, because a lot of historians go, how did this happen? Well, child rearing in Austria is the only time you really touched your child is if you were hitting your child or disciplining. So there wasn't a lot of warmth. My mother, she's all 5'1", and she's never been she's not a cuddly mom. I love my mother, and she soaks it up like a sponge. Now all of us kids are like make a mom sandwich. We're all over her, and at 87, she's just like lets it in. So, on her side of the family, I don't know if her grandfather drank much. There was always beer around. Her brother Merlin. Now, I remember Merlin, from my first memories of Merlin to my last memories of Merlin, is we walked into his house in downtown Chicago, and he was always sitting there in this gray reclining chair, and he had this giant RCA stereo radio color TV. And, going back into the 60s, the colors were a little bit off, all right? they were real off. So as I got older, he was always sitting there smoking and drinking. Smoking and drinking, smoking and drinking. And as I got into the teens, his wife had a stroke, he had tuberculosis, he had emphysema, and I'd still walk over there, and he had this gallon-sized ashtray, one of those massive-sized ashtrays that you could put several cartons of cigarettes in. And he had a carton of Lucky Strikes underneath that and a box of, boxes of matches. And then he also had a church key around his neck. And he would call his wife, who'd kind of walk in there. Remember, she had a stroke. She was doing the step and fetch it. So she was the healthy one, actually. So he would take a smoke. And he also had a handkerchief. He'd take a smoke, take a puff off his Lucky Strike, and start coughing, take a drink of the beer, cough some more, cough into his bloody handkerchief. And then he'd reach over to his oxygen tank and suck on some oxygen. And it's where he died. He smoked himself to death. The gentleman named Dr. Tebow, who became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous by proxy, he had studied alcoholics. He said the number one characteristic of alcoholics is defiance. Merlin was defiant. Doctor says you're coughing up your lungs. Every time you cough, you're bleeding, you know, and every time you smoke, you're coughing. So he's got to stop smoking and stop drinking. He's like, okay. Well, so he didn't do it. You know, when he died, he was about 85 pounds. So that's my grandparents. When my dad was 17, he was, to hear it from his brothers and his sisters is he was the one that was running around the oldest male. He's always protecting his other siblings from beatings and what have you and things like that. So when he was 17, he just had had enough, so he lied about his age and joined the Navy, went to the South Pacific for 4 years. And then when that war was over, he came back to Chicago, and he saw his mother beating, he saw his mother beating his father up. I mentioned this little Polish woman just hammering on this guy. And he's like, he's man, this is too crazy. So he enlisted in the Army and went to Europe. To him, that was, you know, it makes sense. When I was a kid, I was like, what are you thinking of, you know? And now it makes sense. Now that I have an idea about what the disease of alcoholism does is it makes perfect sense to me. It's the only stability, the first stability he had in his life. You know, as he's saying, is there profanity at this meeting?
Oh, yeah.
All right. You know, people say, oh, alcoholism touched my life. You know, and I'm not making fun of it, but alcoholism touches people's lives the same way Mike Tyson touched his opponents in the ring. It wasn't nice. He fucked them up. And you understand what I mean by use of that word. It's very specific. It's like it's alcoholism, it just does not make any sense to me. You know, and for years also, I'm standing here in front of you thinking I'm going to make sense in my share tonight. It's not going to make sense. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the same as my, you know, being in the household I was raised. Cops are the bad guys, moonshiners are the good guys. So, I still have a ways to go. one of my first memories of being a kid. Now my parents they didn't sit around trying to mess me up or any of that. That's what I did. As much as I look back and sometimes went, oh man, I wish they would have said this or treated me different. I'm aware that my mind has been pretty twisted. All right. I was raised around alcoholism. My siblings are different. Hey, Joe. So one of my first memories is I'm 5 years old going to kindergarten on the bus, and my friend Mitch Gullett is sitting with his girlfriend, little girlfriend. She's five, right? They're not serious. And they go, come over and sit with us. You all right? Come over and sit with us. And I distinctly remember looking over the thinking, they're gonna carve me up with knives. They're serious. They're gonna skin me alive. And I didn't remember that until I was, I'll get around to this later, but until I was in a psych ward years later, and the doctors go, tell us your story. And after telling the story about 15 times in one day, because that's what they do, I went, oh yeah, my mind's been twisted ever since, right out of the gate, since I was a kid. So there's a saying that it's meant a lot to me in the last 2 years. It's not from program, but it's put into context. It's helped fill in gaps in my story of like why I've behaved the way I've behaved at times. And yeah, there's alcoholism. I was raised around alcoholism. But Freud, in a very real sense, Freud once said, he goes, unexpressed feelings never die. They're buried alive and will come forth later in uglier ways. I would assert that me at five, you know, because how I was raised was any sort of disagreement was defiance. Now, for years I thought that my dad was like really super strict. He raised us like a platoon. I thought he was really strict because he was in the military, but I know plenty of military guys who aren't that way with their family. when I got here and then I started seeing what, oh, this is what alcoholism does. Because, yeah, it's like, no, I'm going to keep it. This is the way it is. I can see my dad. He's just like, don't do what I do. Do what I say. You're right. There's the chaos. It's like, I don't care if you catch me lying. You're not going to lie. So I, growing up life it seemed pretty normal until I was about, I'm just going to give you the highlights. When I was about 13, I had a crisis, and I was like, oh my God, I'm 13. I haven't done anything with my life. All these other kids are going out and dating and playing football, and here I am just doing whatever. And I thought my life was wasted at that point. I took things a little bit to an extreme. So I set a goal for myself to become the best skier in my high school. Now I was raised in Illinois. I could have been raised in Jamaica for all it cares. So go through high school, and I'm noticing is like I'm having the same theme is like I'm not very trusting of men. Certainly don't trust women. And that's not because they're not trustworthy. It's just I'm frightened. I'm walking around frightened. In hindsight, I can say I'm walking around frightened. If you would have asked me at the time, I would have said I'm fine. All right. I have friends that I don't trust. All right. I have two dates in high school. Now I was literally the idea that I'm standing up here in front of you now and not doubled over is really recovery. Because for years, whenever I'd have feelings like I wanted to get to know somebody, my stomach would just knot up. And once again, it was all those feelings that I'd stuffed down. It was just trying to control and trying to look okay on the outside. You know, and Dad would say, like, yeah, don't talk back to me. And I'd squish it down. And, you know, it wasn't just Dad that I was squishing it down for. It was everybody else. I was hiding my feelings. You know, I was hiding who I was. I didn't want you to know that there was all this yelling and screaming and violence going on in my household. Because, we'd show up and, you know, we'd go out into public and people would comment to my mother, compliment her, go, God, your family's so well-behaved. And I was just bundled up like that. And I also noticed my friends weren't like that either. And I was like, and I started, even as a kid, I was like, there's something wrong here. When I got old enough, I had the desire to control. You know, I think I had one or two, it doesn't even matter about dating. I got into college and I had a roommate and I really wanted to like keep the room this certain way. But I also knew intuitively is like, I'm living with another human being that's not raised the same way. So I would stuff that down too. And I had these impulses to always do these, you know, he'd stand up from my bed because they were situated, and I'd go over there and straighten out the blanket right away. And he would just go, oh man, I'm living with Betty Crocker, you know, right? So I'm going through life. And what's working for me, what's helping me deal with reality, is alcohol. Now, this isn't to qualify as an alcoholic, but what's helping me is alcohol. Until it didn't. All right? Is whatever was going on inside of me surpassed whatever the effect that booze was having on me. I mean, in college, it was great. It's like, you know, gathering my thoughts here. Thinking of college, I should go right to marriage. how I've done a lot of things was by obsessing. You know, how do you get to be, how do I achieve a goal? I obsess, all right, and make that a single priority. So I wanted more than anything to leave Chicago. If you've ever been to Palatine, Illinois, I'm glad to be here. I wanted to leave Chicago. It's not a bad place. I just always knew I'd wind up in Southern California. So I had a couple friends, but not many, but what I would do is I would work full-time during the day, and I'd pick up some classes at night, and then if I had like a Thursday afternoon off, I'd look for a job that I could fill in that Thursday afternoon. So basically, I was working 6 and 7 days a week, always just like occupied and always busy. Moved out here, did the same thing. Finally, you know, went to worked full-time during the day, school at night, and I wasn't having a life, you know, and I didn't know it. I just thought this is the way how you get ahead, you know, just push it a little harder, put my shoulder to the grindstone. So I meet this woman. Some people, their story is like, that they did a lot of dating or they had a lot of relationships. Mine is not that, not at all. I met this woman, and she was my best friend. Love this woman to pieces. And what happens is there gets to be a point where she's like, where I'm getting a little obsessive, and she's like, oh, maybe we should take a little break here. And so what I hear is like, I need more attention. So, all right, you get. That's what I thought I heard. And so then this happens, and this happens, and I start. And what it is we're just about to break up, and I'm losing my mind. I'm not kidding. I'm just like, oh my God, how am I gonna do this? Her brother kills himself. All right, she moves away. Now this is her last living, she had an aunt. This is her last living family member, direct family member. Everyone else is gone. She moves away. She comes back a couple years later and just decides, you know, let's pick this up where we go on. And I'm like, nah, I don't know. And we date, not date. And I'm like, nah, I don't know. I don't know. Well, you know, I don't give much advice even to sponsees. But one thing I will say is, as advice is, don't take ecstasy and get engaged. Yeah. It doesn't make for a good foundation. Well, like the alcohol, you know, or like anything else that could just, you know, gave me a moment, is I just turned to her, and she's the only woman I'd loved, I mean, really had feelings for, other than just like wacky obsession. And of course, then I came to the next morning, and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? We talk about it, and somewhere along in there, I heard myself tell myself, it'll be good for you. All right, it'll be good for you. We get married. I discover I have no skills. I have no skills. She doesn't behave like my mom will. Not that I really expected her, but I noticed I'm starting to take on the same attitudes that my family had. Anyway, I finally get into the business that I really want, and I start working and working and working, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. That I can control. That I have a role, and that I have relationships. I know how to behave as the role of my job title, and the rest of it is I just leave that to, you know, that's personal life. I don't want it, don't need it. Not to say that I was just going home and watching soaps. My activities of choice are things like skiing, windsurfing, mountain biking. They're not team sports. You know, right? At about this time, I am picking up a couple friendships, but I'm still going off doing these things. Now I'm finally like trying to be, you know, friends with people and starting to trust one or two men here and there. My life is still pretty small, and outside work is I'm still in the gaga stage about with adults. Well, people, they don't want to hang out with me anymore, because every time we go out and go mountain biking, somebody comes back broken or bloody. you know, is like, I don't have a governor. I don't have a governor. I'm like, it's just full on. You know, it's like there's no, I don't have any boundaries. So wife and I split. Marriage is the number one cause of divorce. I had to throw that in. Where am I going to go now? So my life starts outside. All I have is work. And outside of life it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I live 10 blocks away from work, and I work at least five days a week, and it's usually six or seven. And then on the way home, I stop by Rocket Video down on La Brea, and I pick up two videos on Tuesday and Thursday, and then one every other day of the week. And then I go home, and I cook up a bag of microwave popcorn and a big pot of sleepy time tea, and that's how I spend the next 3-4 hours every night. So I was seeing about 800 movies a year. Life is getting smaller, and now I'm starting. You know that quote about Freud is I'm starting to get feelings just around friends. You know, people say they're triggered about things. I didn't know what. It didn't matter what triggered me, but everything started coming up, and I had no way to deal with all these things that I had stuffed. I don't have any tools for living, and of course my girlfriend lives in Chicago. She doesn't live in Burbank. I'm dating somebody in Chicago, so my picker I was kissing a lot of frogs, but my picker was busted in this particular time. I think I'm going to surprise her. I'm in Vail, Colorado, so I drive 1,100 miles to Chicago to surprise her. and I arrive just in time for her to come home from a holiday weekend with her ex-boyfriend in Oklahoma. And I was like, wow. And I thought, we can deal with this. I can handle this. I can do this. And I just shoved it down. And that night I got up, and it would be the first time I tried to kill myself. I went into this garage, I tried to asphyxiate myself, and it was like, no, nobody is worth dying for. Nobody. I mean, I was just having these feelings, and I just felt like dying. I was like, I had no idea how to deal with these or where they were coming from. I could understand being upset, but I didn't. These feelings, they were huge. Obviously, we split up. I drive back to Los Angeles, and those feelings, that sort of event, starts happening. First, it started happening every 2 months, and then it happened every month, and it started happening every week, and then it would happen. I'd just be driving down Laurel Canyon, and I'd just get this thing, and I just get knotted up with this. I guess it's fear now. I mean, I'm not going to claim it was fear. I don't know what it was. It was everything I could feel. And my only answer is, like, my fear is that this is going to last like this forever. And my only answer to try and calm it down, to see a light at the end of the tunnel, is that I'm going to drive my car into a light pole. Actually, a light pole's not a good idea. They're aluminum. They'll fall over. You need to hit one of the power poles. And so this becomes a regular thing. So now every couple of days, I was out on a date. All right, we're watching this movie, and there's this black dress in the movie, and coming home from that weekend with her ex-boyfriend was a black dress in her bag, and I triggered. And in 90 seconds, I'm like, I gotta get up and I gotta go to the bathroom, but my legs won't move. And if I do get up and go to the bathroom, I'm going to hurt myself. And I just sat there, and I was just gripping. I was just like, oh, my God. I just waited for it to pass. And it was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. That's what I do remember about it. A real touchy-feely guy. So anyway, what's happening is this starts happening on a regular basis. And here's probably the last time I tried it was now I know I don't think I'm suicidal, because I wouldn't be here. I have this gun. I'm like, oh, I pick it up, and I'm like, got my hands free. I finally, it's like 800 pounds. I finally get it up to my head. I put it up to here, and my last thought before I squeeze the trigger and put the bullet through my head is, this is right next to your ear. It's going to be really loud. And I'm thinking, my ears are going to be ringing for days. And in that, I'm not kidding. And in that split, I just dropped it. And I was like, oh my God, I don't want to die. I knew I didn't want to die. And somehow I needed to get help. That would take me to a psych ward, UCLA psych ward. I call it a bed and breakfast. And they'll tell you right away. You go in for the, I think it's called a 5150. You go and tell them. I got up the next morning and they said, "Listen, we know you don't belong here." I mean, psych ward is serious. There are people that will never leave that room, never leave that floor in UCLA. They're going to be heavily medicated. So you can leave here and go get help. These people can't. A little bit after that. Early on, someone had said, some friends were telling me about Al-Anon, and I was like, well, I knew alcoholism ran in my family. But I approach it the way, like, some people go, oh, I'm gonna go skydiving, you know, I'm gonna go skydiving someday, I'm gonna join Al-Anon someday. And I never really seriously thought I'd get around to it. I thought it'd be something good for retirement. You know, that's the attitude I had about it. Well, I don't remember who told me about the meeting, but I walk into this meeting on a Saturday morning, and there were a couple of people that I recognized there, and it felt right. I didn't know what the problem was, but it was fixing me. You know, I felt like I was in the right place. And at the end of the meeting, I was talking to this woman, Amy, and she's like, "Oh, you're new. Why are you here?" And I just talked to her. And she didn't try and correct me. She didn't try and change me. She didn't try and fix me. She didn't try and tell me what was wrong with me or what I was going through, trying to contextualize it. She just listened, and she's like, "Well, I'm glad you're here. Keep coming back." And I felt like I was welcome. I felt like I had some possibility here, because I hadn't figured it out. Most of my life, anywhere I went, I had to know why I was there and what I was going to do there, you know? And I just kept on coming and coming and coming and coming. The little by little is, I didn't mean to, but I started getting friends here. My friend Tony used to come sunglasses on his head. And I'd sit there. Now, this is something I've known since I was a kid, that if I see someone and I have strong feelings towards them, I may look at them and go, who's that clown, all right? But I know we will become close. And that I've known that ever since I was a kid. And I'm looking at this guy going, what's with the sunglasses on the head? I mean, it's like indoors, you know, right? Well, Sunday, anyway, we start chatting, and one day he's, I have this four-wheel drive Jeep, I'm going to go out to Death Valley, and I made the mistake of letting him know what he was doing. And he goes, "Hey, you mind if I come?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah." And it started building this friendship. He's one of the people that I call when I get past the 800-pound phone. I had several sponsors, but what would happen is I'd ask them to be my sponsor, and then I'd never see them again. They'd stop going to that meeting. One guy I asked to be my sponsor, he said, "Yeah." And then the next time I saw him was 4 years later on the 101. And I look up, and he's like, "I'm not in program anymore." And so I got a sponsor. She was sitting in, I've been a couple of years, like 2-3 years, and she was sharing with me, her name's Kay, she'd pretty much given up on relationships, and this man just walked into her life, and she was like, I want nothing to do with you. Well, we've been together about 15 years, 16 years. The thing is that when I saw the way she was she wasn't sitting there going, "Oh, wait till I find Mr. Right." She was like, no, she wasn't hopeful. She wasn't optimistic. She had faith, and she was patient, and she had an open mind. That's not what she was looking for. Her life is fine. She walked through life and said, "I'm fine." You know, and she'd been in a program, I think, at 20 years at that time. She's, "I'm fine the way I am." And she brings this full life into this relationship. And I was like, that's the attitude I want. I want to know that I'm okay the way I am. you know, that I don't have to run off and do something to fix myself. There are, we're going to talk about the steps. Where was I? K. So, I don't, you know, Al-Anon is a, for me, it's not the get the better date relationship kind of program. I don't want to make it sound like it is or it is. I was just trundling along. It was about 10 years ago. I was in New York, and I was working, and it was at night. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and the three of us stuff ourselves into the back of this cab, and we're flying down Lexington, and this guy, the cab driver, is from Senegal. And he speaks a little bit of English. I speak a little bit of French, and we start going back and forth. I go, oh, Senegal, Jean Dakar, you know, because it's Dakar. Anyway. So anyway, we start yakking, and he's oh, I have eight children. I go, oh my God, how do you have eight children? I know how you have eight children. I go, why do you have eight children? He goes, oh, da, 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 da. And he goes, are you married? I said, no. And he goes, well, why not? I said, well, what do you say to a cab driver in New York? I said, well, I guess I haven't met the right woman. And he turns around, and he goes, we're flying, this is Lexington. If it's just a southbound, we're going through an intersection. He goes, but are you being the right kind of man? I was like, that's a very good question. And I actually had, it was presence of mind to just go, I don't know that I am. You know, am I being the right kind of man? Not just for that, but how, you know, is what's, for years I've been saying the prayer, God, please make me the best man you could be. All right. But I still kind of go, yeah, you do that while I'm off here doing this. All right. It's like, no, I need to take action. I still need the steps have principles. Example, the first step, we came to believe the power greater than us. Gotcha. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. Maybe that principle for that would be honesty, willingness. The Big Book talks about willingness as being, I mean, this the Big Book is just laced with the word willingness. And I realized I had to embody these steps. You know, I had to really like break down what these steps mean to me and not just go, oh yeah, I'm in the second step. Well, what is the second step? You know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. When I looked at that, I realized that I had a lot of higher powers. The girlfriend in Chicago, she was actually very serious. She was very good at being a higher power. She was kind, she was loving. But she told me when we started dating, you don't want to be involved with me. Did I listen? I had a lot of higher powers. I have a garage full of higher powers. You know, toys. But the caveat is, that could restore us to sanity. You know, I realized that I had a lot of higher powers, but it's always still trying to fill this God-shaped hole in me. Whether it be by doing, you know, things, it was things, or more meetings, or something like that. Once again, it was telling myself, I needed to do more. But once I found this higher power, and actually I did shortly after being in Al-Anon, a couple months later, and I have a pretty good idea. What it was is I had a moment of serenity. And I knew it was a genuine moment of serenity because I didn't care how long it lasted. I didn't care where it came from. I didn't know how I met. My mind didn't race in trying to remember a way of remanufacturing it. But I was like, this is worth the whole journey right up into this moment. I mean, I burned my life down. And this is worth the whole journey right here. I could die and I'd be a happy man. That's the higher power I needed to go find. And so I needed to behave in a different way. How much time do I have? Like, is there a timer? 20 minutes? Well, I'm watching this TV show called Vikings. Let me tell you about that. Wow. For some reason told me it was like 8:15 in my head. You know, Emo Williams, the comedian, has a saying. He goes, I used to think my mind was the most important part of my body until I realized where I was getting that information from. what do I have to say? So, my dad's 89, my mom's 87. I go home at least once a year. Work usually prevents it from happening in the middle of the year. They still live in Chicago. My older sister lived 2 doors away. Brother lives with them. He's been looking after them for several years now. My younger sister, she lives in the area. And, you know, I can tell each of them could use some Al-Anon. All right. More about that in a minute. All right. For years, you're never going to meet her. So for years, my older sister's been going, oh, Dad's going to go. He's going to go any day now. You know? And she's been telling me that for about 20 years. He's going to go. No, my dad did construction. All right. And he's like, at 89, he still is a bulldog. He still builds dollhouses, mows the lawn himself. The thing he looks forward to during the day is feeding. They have this bird feeder, and he feeds that twice a day because it's emptied. They have so many birds and so many geese. And and he's like, there's more geese out in there. Well, so I hear he's having a hard time sleeping. So I go home and I'll try melatonin. I'm not trying to run his life or anything like that. I said, but you know, you ought to try this, and you know, this is what works for me, and just trying to be the best son I can. And sometimes he gets, a couple of years ago, I came home and I laced this in there. He tells me the story. He goes, you know, my ex-wife, who I'm still close with, she's a music professor. After we split up, she went on to get her master's, her PhD. She's a doctor in music composition. She did her Fulbright scholarship, and then she lived in Amsterdam for a couple of years, and now she's a professor. All because of me. So she lives up in Wisconsin, so I was going to come home and spend a couple of days with Joanne and then come back down. And my dad heard that, and he decided that he didn't like that idea, but I didn't know that. And I walk in, and there's that. If you've ever been around our high tension wires, there's that feeling. It's like in the atmosphere. Just that there's something going on. You know, and if you've ever been around somebody who's like stuck in their head, you know it. You're like, whoa, please come back. We need you here on planet Earth. All right. So my dad's. I walk in, and I know right away at the airport he's up with something, and he goes. So I hear you're gonna go visit your ex-wife. I'm like, yeah. He goes, you still chasing that thing? And I'm like, all right. And he goes, you know, your mother was crying hearing that you were gonna go up north and, you know, and doing this. And I'm like, well, all right. You know, and over the course of a couple of days, I decide I'm gonna stay. Because it's gonna be, you know, I'd rather be happy than right. Turns out my mother had, this is the first she heard about it. My dad just decided he wanted me to stay in Chicago, all right? It's not like there was snow to shovel. He just decided he wanted this to feel better for him. So that's my dad. That's a couple years ago. Last year, he's having trouble sleeping. Gets about 90 minutes of sleep a night, and he gets up. Walks, sleeps in his chair for half an hour, gets up, and he walks all around the house. Now, for a guy in his 80s, that's not really good. Well, there was one thing that he had said he would never do, and that would be to lay a hand on my mother. He walks out, slaps my mom. My brother's just like, whoa, separates the two of them, and my dad realizes what he did. He goes... gets a gun, goes in the backyard, tries to shoot himself, But fortunately, there's no magazine in the gun. All right. He's like, oh my, I gotta get out of here. He's full of shame now. All right. He goes for a walk. Now my, I get this phone call from my older sister. Dad ran away. Now it's no laughing matter, but all right, my dad is using a walker, so he's just like, all right. So I kind of smile and go, oh, he's ran away. Okay. So she gets in the car, she calls the police, and she starts driving all over the neighborhood. And I'm like, how long ago did he leave? She's, oh, about a half an hour ago. I'm like, okay, so he's probably at the corner by now. All right. Well, it turns out about a half hour, 45 minutes later, is he walked to the corner, walked to the liquor store, and I think he was going to buy a lotto ticket or something like that. I mean, he's not a drinker. He wasn't buying a bottle of cheap Jameson's or whatever. Anyway, my sister's driving miles around. I'm like, you know, what's the first thing you do? Radius, you know, right? I remember that scene in The Fugitive, you know, Tommy Lee Jones. He goes, a human walking on foot covers 20 miles in an hour. You know, that's the first thing I thought of. And my dad's like, he's probably covering about 300 yards in an hour. So this liquor store is about a quarter mile away, a little bit more than that. Well, he's walking back, and a policeman's there, and he goes, hey, Ed. And he's like, hey, how you doing? You know, they start talking. He says, yeah, we're looking for you. Your family's worried. He says, oh, okay. And so he tells the cop what happened. And the cop is just like, okay, you know, why don't you have a seat in the car? I'm not going to lock you in. And he sits in the car. And because he said, because he tried to harm himself, he has to call it in for 5150. They come, pick him up. I take my dad away. And he's going into a psych ward, and they check him out, and they discover that these medications that he's had, he's in there for like 5 days, and they discover that the medication that he's being prescribed causes paranoia, insomnia, anxiety, and this is supposed to be good for him, all right. So they finally get him all straightened out, and I was back home in December. And he sits me down, and he starts telling me this guy's my hero, all right. I may have been disappointed at times, all right. You know, as in a healthy way, in a very adult way, but this guy is my hero, all right. He's the guy that told me, you know, yeah, you don't know how to take that engine apart that you busted. You're going to learn. Why? Because you can. Because you know. Why not? So he starts telling me about what's going on. He's like, I don't know what I did, you know. You know, and I start telling him, I go, you know, Dad, I should have never told the cop that I tried to hurt myself. And he's starting to beat himself up. I go, Dad, you know, that's law. You tried to hurt yourself. It's for your own good. I go, you know, and I tell him for the first time. He didn't know. I said, listen, I went in the psych ward, and I tried to hurt myself. I didn't tell him about having the 9mm, it wouldn't have been funny at that time. But I got to sit there and listen with my dad, and not criticize him. I got to love him. I got to treat him like Amy treated me in my first meeting. You know, that, you know, I'm not even going to start listing names of the people here that just love me through whatever I'm going through. And I usually don't say anything because I still have that thing like I don't know what I'm going through, so I'm not going to say anything. I haven't figured it out yet. But I got to sit there and listen to my dad. You know, he's just like oh, I don't know what I'm doing with my life, and he's 89, looking for the next thing to do. You know. So I've been able to be of service to my father that way. Something I found out, we found out, is now at 17 he went in the military. So for the last 72 years he's been suffering from PTSD. And hearing that, I went, it filled me with compassion. Now here's a guy, not because he was hell to live with or something like that, but I look over at this guy and I'm like, all I want to do is hold him and give him a piece of that serenity I felt. You know, here's a man, you know, he's like, look where he came from. It doesn't add up, you know? And he's suffered most of his life. And my mom, I don't think she gets enough attention. She doesn't command enough attention. I try and give it to her, but I'm like, pretty much the only thing that she's going to complain about to me is that she doesn't get any gardening done while the ground's frozen. You know, that's my mom. In that same visit, you know, my brother's, I love him, but he's my brother, okay? Be in a room, TV's on, and he's talking. I don't know if he's talking to the TV or talking to me, but he's always monologuing, just going out. There's a fourth person in the room, and I don't know what. And I'm trying to watch this TV, and finally, Jack, are you going to talk? Are you talking to me or what? And he got upset, and he walked away, and I was like, yeah, heck with him. And then it took about half an hour later, I went, oh, that's not very enlightened. That's not how I would want to be treated by someone. So I get to go to my, I go up, I find my brother. He's washing dishes, and he's got his face in out the backyard full of birds. And his shoulders are up like this, and I go, can't really get around the side because it's a small kitchen. I go, Jack, I want to apologize. You know, I need to make amends to you for behaving the way I did. That's not how anybody should treat anybody else. You know, that might be how we used to treat each other, but that doesn't that's not who I am these days. And I apologize for that. I hope you accept my apology, and I'm not going to do it again. And as I was doing it, his shoulders just went like this. And then, you know, he turned around, and I don't remember what he was talking about. He was like a puppy. He was like, we're friends again. You know, that forever changes us. You know, I now know, and he knows that I have the ability to make amends for my actions, that I'm not going to leave him hurting. I'm going to wrap it up pretty soon. I'm going to try and wrap up with this. So the last couple years I've become an Alateen sponsor. And I don't have any kids. I rent. But I've been the uncle that shows up with the mini bike or the rock climbing gear or shows them how to fix their bicycle. As I'm working in my garage at home, kids come by and I fix the bicycle. They see all these motorcycles out there because that's what I do to relax. And they come by, hey, you know, my bike is doing, and I fix their bike. Anyway, so I'm looking at these kids, and so I become an Alateen sponsor to these kids. And now they don't ask me questions about any steps. They don't work the steps. My job is just to make sure that they don't burn the place down. And if they do, that they don't get hurt in the process. So one day they're like, James, yeah, you an Al-Anon? I'm like, yeah. He goes, why? I go, well, you know, I got 45 minutes, you know. And I tell him, I said, my family and all that. And he goes, really? And they go, did you ever drink? I go, yeah. You know, you do now? No, and I say that not to identify. I go, no, I don't drink anymore. And they're like, wait a minute, you're an Al-Anon, and you come here. Why do you come here? I'm like, so I could be of service. And I realized that for them, I was the only adult male that they knew that was an Al-Anon and wasn't a drunk. And I went, wow, I had no idea. Well, I got that going for me. How did that happen? You know, all I ever wanted to be, you know, whether I thought I could be it or not, I thought it was a little bit too high-minded, was just to be a contribution, you know. And my time here in Al-Anon has actually made that a possibility. And thank you for my recovery. Thank you for sharing my feelings when I don't know what I'm feeling. Thanks for showing up week after week after week after week. I see people that are new and they just keep coming back, and you know, it means a lot to me. It means a lot to people that have been here for a while. Thank you. Good night.